Bates with Harvey. 8 seconds, he's in the corner, jacks up at three. Harvey's
got it!
Tyler Harvey!
Wow.
5.7 on the clock, timeout Melbourne!
And Ian Clark cannot believe it. He was right there in his grill, and Tyler Harvey just made the biggest shot of his career.
6 seconds flat. It's going to be inbounded to Delly. There's the first piece. Delly looking to Golding. Golding loose to win it! Hearts are shattered in Melbourne.
Oh, my God.
Hawks take it.
Wow.
Brand new series. Wow. Tyler Harvey kicks the door down.
Delivered over on the spin move. Blows past Harvey. Throws up a floater. It's good. This game's done. It's over. Timeout Illawarra. Melbourne are going to win game three. Matthew Delivered over has been magnificent in this fourth period. But once again, it's exactly the same story as game one. This Illawarra team does not know how to close it out. It's an experienced thing. That team in blue, just way too experienced.
Big moments, big players, big shots. It's what you want in an NBL Championship Series. And this one has had everything you could imagine and then some. Except a team winning on their home court. Justin Tatum said it yesterday in the post-game press conference, amongst a lot of things he said yesterday. First team to win a home game wins the championship. So we'll see you in Melbourne. And indeed, we will see you in Melbourne on Wednesday night. United 2-1 up in the series. Though maybe not the way that most people expected this time last week. Illawarra coming down here to Melbourne. Tyler Harvey hitting the shot of his NBL career. They dance off the floor. Shai Ili gone for game three. We still don't know his status for game four in concussion protocols. The deck seems stacked for the Hawks. But once again, Melbourne United, ever the professionals in the postseason. They went to Wollongong and they did it again. And now Wednesday night, just 48 hours from when we're recording this, they have the chance to lock up their third championship in the last 8 years. Welcome to the roundtable. Julian Marcus and Matt McQuaid with you once again. Matty, we've still got a live series this week, so that's one positive. I'm looking at it from an Illawarra perspective. You've still got a lot of hope, I think, going into Wednesday night. And if there is one thing that we've seen throughout this postseason is that hope can take you a fair distance. But boy, oh boy, what a performance yesterday for Melbourne United.
It was outstanding. Hello, Julian. Hello, everybody listening around the world. It was a great performance from them. And they had to withstand several Illawarra charges to get there. But again, they never let it get out of control. And they turned it into their kind of game, which was they slowed it down. They were more physical. They made better decisions. They pounced on every Illawarra mistake. That was a huge key to the ball game. But again, I use that word experience. Game three came down to a simple fact that Melbourne United knows to do exactly what to do in these situations, and Illawarra doesn't. And it's simple, cold, hard truth about this series. The other cold, hard truth about this series is that Dean Vickerman is the best coach in the series. That's an absolute positive for me, that he is out-coaching Justin Tatum at the moment. He's making better adjustments. He's responding to everything that Illawarra is throwing at them. And I kind of feel like Illawarra in that fourth quarter in particular, it was exactly the same as game one. It was just, we don't know what to do in these situations. We don't know where to get a basket. As simple as that. We don't understand how to get there when, you know, they're top blocking all their shooters. They're forcing them out of their rhythm. And Illawarra don't have it. They don't seem to have a counter to what Melbourne's doing defensively in the clutch at the moment. So, I mean, let's be honest, Julian. Where a rim out Chris Golding three from this being a sweep potentially? And as I said to you, had Melbourne won that game, and I'm even more convinced about, you know, that I know it's a what if, but if Melbourne had won game two, we'd be talking about the end of the series right now.
Yeah, I agree.
I just think, and that's why I thought I just had the feeling, and I mean, game three came down when Illawarra got to that lead, they couldn't put them away. I thought, okay, they're in trouble because Melbourne is going to figure it out. And they did. And yeah, you say where there's life, there's hope. I think the series is on serious life support. That's what I think. I think there's a glimmer of hope. I don't think there's much hope at all. I think Melbourne is about ready to put Illawarra to the sword in game four. I just, again, you know, look, the series has been close. It's been close. And look, you know, it's incredible to think. I think it's now going on 7 games where the margin of victory, 7 grand final / championship series games is concerned. That is, that 7 straight games where the margin's been single digits. And of course, Sunday afternoon was the 6th consecutive time that a road team has won a championship series game, which is remarkable and unprecedented. So, because you go back to last year, obviously Tasmania winning the 2 games in Melbourne, Melbourne winning in MyState Bank Arena. And then this year, United coming in not once but twice into one of the most hostile environments there is right now in the National Basketball League and coming through both times and sending those fans home very upset, very disappointed. And I you know, game one, the atmosphere after game one, we talked about this last week. I kind of felt like it, you know, there was still the hope was there. You know, the Illawarra chant was there. They were still, yesterday afternoon, they trudged out very quietly. And I think with an acknowledgement, it's going to take a miracle for them to win. It really is. And particularly given Kel's status. You know, we don't know what that is at the moment. Whether he will play or not. If he doesn't play, I know JT in the press conference said next man up mentality, but the truth of the matter is if they don't have a healthy Trey Kell, I don't think they've got much of a chance at all, in all honesty.
And we'll get on to this because we'll do a review of both game two and game three. Why is it that Illawarra have not been able to close out both games at home but were able to get the job done away?
Well, I think away, it's a different paradigm for a young team, youngish team. And what I mean by, youngish team, they pretty much are. But again, no one really expected them to win game two, right? So it was a bit of a free hit. It was a combination of factors. I don't think Melbourne were as sharp defensively. Clearly they weren't. They gave them, you know, 100 points, 102 points, which I said was probably the only way that Illawarra was going to win. So that was one thing. And I just felt they looked a lot freer and easier. Like they had not a care in the world as such until, of course, they built that lead. And in the fourth quarter, they virtually nearly choked it away. So they've had these problems all 3 games where it's you get into these scenarios against a team that you know has so many players in it that have been there before, that have been in this situation many, many, many times. And know how to get it done. And a head coach, by the way, of the same ilk. Multiple championship winner has seen everything and done everything in this league. And then you've got guys like Dellavedova, who've won NBA championships, and Clark, of course, another NBA champion. You know, it was interesting in game three, Truckee pointed out Melbourne started Ian Clark, and he said, they started Marcus Lee, and Truckee said, there's 4 guys that have played in the NBA. And Chris Golding, who should have played in the NBA. It's an unbelievable starting unit. It's incredible. And he was right, you know, when you look at it that way. But, yeah, I think it's just – and especially at home. I mean, people say, look, you know, playing at home should be easier. But it really isn't in that sort of environment in some way. I mean, I'll tell you a story. I mean, when the Kings – again, you know, it's my experience, but and people might get bored of it. But the 2008 – grand final, which went to 5 games, one of the great grand finals of all time, after the Kings beat the Tigers in game 4 in Melbourne, that legendary game. So they came back and they hadn't had a crowd all year at the entertainment center. You know, they were averaging about 4,000 to 5,000 maybe. And over 10,000 people showed up for game 5. And I remember Gorge telling the story. He sort of looked out and said, oh my God, look at all these people. And the guys weren't used to it. And no, you know, I'm not taking anything away from Melbourne at the time, but there was that kind of thing where just the pressure and the expectation of that home crowd mounted on them, and Melbourne got the best of them, especially in the clutch after they trailed at the half. And it's the same. And I think it's a very similar situation for these guys. Now, they've had these great crowds all year, but regular season, even the semifinals, is, again, it's just a completely different ball game, completely different. When you get to a championship situation, especially a club that hasn't been to a grand final in a very long time, what is it, 8 years? The last three times they've gotten to that semi-final stage, haven't gone any further. So this is a brand new experience for them, and they've got home court advantage. So it's almost a self-imposed pressure in some respects, because you just want to do so well for those amazing Hawkheads, the home fans that have done a phenomenal job all season long, right? I mean, most fans they've ever had in a season, I think, and certainly the most sellouts they've ever had by a long way. So, yeah, I think that's part of it. I think part of it's mental. I also think part of it is the fact that, again, they're going up against a team that is coached by, I think Dean Vickerman might even be the MVP of the series. I mean, obviously, from a playing perspective, I think it's Matty Dellavedova right now, just in front of Ian Clark. But, you know, in all honesty, you know, I think Vickerman has been outstanding. You know, I already think he's a phenomenal coach. But the job he has done and the moves, he's like a puppet master. You know, I mean, who would have thought he'd put Tom Coppins out there early in the first quarter in game three? I was shocked. But that's the kind of moves that he will make. And the fact that they got that done without Shai Ili was incredible. But again, from the Hawks' perspective, I just think a lot of it is just there's expectation. And I said this prior to the finals even. I said they aren't used to being the favorite. They aren't used to being in this situation. And I think we're seeing the end result of that right now. So, which is why I say, I mean, if Kell doesn't play, I can't see them winning. But, and I think Melbourne will probably win pretty comfortably. And we'll obviously get on to the preview in a minute. But, you know, sort of looking ahead, I think, the only thing that might be in their favour is that lack of expectation to get game four like it was in game two. I mean, I think most people expected Melbourne to win that. And let's face it, they almost did. But it was also a game where Illawarra played, you know, some outstanding basketball, particularly offensively. And, you know, they got stuff done that they haven't been able to get done in the two home games that they've had.
Something also I picked up looking at the Hawks' history that I missed last week in particular. We talk about the club as a whole, and it's not just when it comes to players, but it comes to the club and it comes to the fan base. We need to remember, it's one thing to have not won a championship for 24 years, but Matt, do you remember how many games in the NBL Grand Final / Championship Series that Illawarra has won coming into this series since then?
Yeah, I think it's...
One.
One, yeah.
Against Perth in 2010.
Because it's four, they've won four, yeah. So coming into yesterday, they'd won four in total. So that would be the two plus the one in 2010, yeah. So that, exactly. You know, it's like they just... And now, cool, look, that's history, and that's obviously, you know, a long way from this team. But, yeah, it's just something about that franchise. They, you know, they just are used to being the underdog. And it kind of worked for them in game two a little bit because, you know, it's part of it is, well, we can just have a free hit. Nobody believes in us. Part of it is that additional motivation. And then part of it is really not having the pressure that I think a lot of them are putting on themselves, you know, especially at home.
That's what makes game four so interesting to me is, well, nobody gave Illawarra much chance going into last Wednesday. Even less will give them a chance going into this Wednesday.
100%.
We'll get there, though, in due time in this program. But as far as game two, I want to start there and give the two games the respect that and the love that they deserve because they were both great games of basketball for various reasons. To be in the arena last Wednesday night, 9,135. And by the way, if you're listening to this show and you haven't got a ticket for Wednesday night, it's too late because I guarantee you what's left. There were about 10 left when I last looked. They're gone.
Oh, there you go. Sell out. Thank God.
Absolute sellout. They're putting in extra seats on the roof, last I heard. They are
anywhere, right. Wow.
Anywhere they can find a seat, they are going to use them, United.
Yeah,
tickets
terrific.
Are very, very scarce right about now. So it's going to be a 10,000 sellout. I think we could be looking at just not – I've just got to get up the – record as far as a John Cain Arena basketball crowd, but we could be looking at 10,500, even more than that. It's going to be, I think, the biggest crowd that Melbourne United have seen in that building, at least in its current constitution, which it should be, because they've got a chance to win the title. But the noise that that crowd made last Wednesday night at times was, it was as loud as I've ever heard it in there. Granted, I haven't been down here all that long, nearly four years now. Jeez, that gets away.
But, no, it does,
But I haven't heard it that loud. And I stand to be corrected, but I haven't heard it that loud in the last 4 years. They were absolutely outstanding. And, you know, the Illawarra Hawks, to go into that scenario when they had, it was a carbon copy of Game 3 in the Game 1. So that was the situation they were going into. For them to put themselves in the position through three quarters to win the game was quite extraordinary. And it was everything, as far as the Hawks were concerned, that we come to know about them throughout the year. We thought, okay, these guys had figured out through three quarters. Jeez, it was so impressive the way that the Hawks were able to get things going and to lock things down and to frustrate United.
Mm.
But I put in the caveat. When Shea Ely went out of the game.
Yeah, well, that was the...
United, again, and how often have we seen it? The record was 7-12 going into yesterday for United games without Shea Ely in the last few years. And he is the bellwether. He is the cornerstone of this team. And we saw it again because Tyler Harvey was getting no space when Shea Ely was chasing him around the floor. He goes out of the game, all of a sudden Tyler Harvey starts getting more free.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, that certainly was a big part of it. No question about it. I thought it was, to be honest with you, Illawarra obviously executed very well offensively in those first three periods. And I thought, you know, the key was really Sam Frohling and his just relentless attack inside, you know, getting those guys in foul trouble. And there were three things, you know, that were the real key for me in the game. One was fouls, obviously. Foul trouble.
Oh, boy, was it.
One was offensive rebounds. That was another one. You know, Illawarra grabs 22 of their 42 rebounds at the offensive end of the floor, which led to 15 second chance points, which isn't really many. But then the other one was turnovers. And that's what really killed Melbourne more than anything else, particularly in those first three quarters. Because, I mean, they turned the ball over 16 times, but the important thing was Illawarra converted those 16 turnovers into 26 points. That is a ton off those Melbourne mistakes. And, you know, they dominated them in the paint, 58 points in the paint. They, you know, again, haven't shot the ball well from three all series, pretty much, you know, except for game three against the Phoenix most of the playoffs. But it didn't matter because there was that constant attack. They force-fed Frohling, which was the right thing to do, and it was, you can get onto game three in a minute, but that was a huge mistake in game three, not getting Sam more touches, quite frankly. They did a bad job with that and just relied on the three ball way too much. But getting back to this game, that should have been the blueprint for game three as well, is force-feed Sam Frohling because he is very effective. I mean, Rob Lowe can't guard him straight up. Melbourne was sending a help or helpers at times. I mean, I saw them triple team him a couple of times in the post. They were that terrified of him once he got the ball deep, those deep catches. And the thing about Sam is the sneaky thing is that he's got several moves down there. It's not just a matter of, you know, he's just going to use his left hand and try and, you know, finish strong at the rim. He can go either way. Obviously, he's more effective with the left, but he's developed his right hand quite nicely. So he's a very, very difficult matchup if he gets the ball in certain positions in the low block, in pretty much any position now in the low block, and even from kind of the foul line extended, he can be a threat. So, yeah, I mean, that was a real key to the game, I felt, with him. But ultimately, as I said, you know, yes, Tyler makes the shot of his life. And, you know, yes, he and Trey Kell had a big game offensively, although Kell didn't shoot the ball well. That's been a problem for him all series. But really, it was fouls, foul trouble. It was turnovers, and it was offensive rebounds. And those were the three things that Illawarra really hurt Melbourne dramatically in that game. And like I said, you know, part of it was also the fact that they played with a level of freedom that they had been most of the season, right? Especially, you know, we've spoken about it. One of the greatest, if not the greatest, offenses in NBL history, especially from a statistical standpoint, when your offensive ratings, you know, are very gaudy, 125.2 in the regular season. So from that aspect, it was more them. You know, I felt watching the game that it was more like them. They still got good contributions off the bench. I mean, 25 points, they've had better, you know, from a points perspective, but everybody contributed. Everybody had their moment. Lachlan Ulbrich was strong in his minutes. You know, probably only Toddy Blanchfield didn't take a shot unusually, still grabbed four rebounds, couple of offensive. Dan Greeter brought the energy. Dave O'Hickey did his thing. H.J. Lee didn't play all that much. And I still think they have to think about, particularly if Kel's out, they've got no choice. He's just going to have to play a lot more. I know Justin is probably concerned about the defense, but hey, you know, I mean, he can get the job done from that that side of the ball with some help. So, yeah, I mean, it was a great effort. But again, it was funny because that was for three quarters.
Yeah.
That fourth quarter, once Melbourne, and it was sort of like, oh no, here we go again. And stuff started to be short. I mean, Froling was short at the rim a couple of times, and they were a little fumbly, and then the crowd was getting into it. And as you said, it was incredibly loud. You know, great call by you. And the atmosphere, I mean, it's a funny thing. I don't know what it is, but the atmosphere, you know, it's a little self-serving to say this, but the atmosphere on the collective just seems to come through a lot better than what it does on television for some strange reason. I don't know why that is, but there seems to be like a, I don't know, what's the word? Like, it's almost like a rumble, you know, like a thunder, you know, you can sort of hear and feel it a lot more. So that came through with you know, the call you and Tommy did was great. And, you know, and the Hawks obviously felt that as well, right? Because you could just see it coming and coming and coming. And then, you know, it Harvey makes the ultimate boneheaded play. And then, to his immense credit, finds redemption with the shot of his life over Clark, ironically. Yeah. So, yeah, and they got the job done. But only after having to survive, yeah, it was Banks. But how many times have we seen this story? Golding has a shot to win. Yes, it was contested, but not super tough. It was a shot that he's made time and time again in his career, and he almost made it. And like I said, I think we could have been legitimately looking at a sweep. I mean, I did say in game, you know, I did say prior to that I felt like if they'd lost game two, the Hawks, that they would get swept. And I think I would have been proven correct.
I think you've been vindicated with that on the back of what we saw in game three.
Yep.
I went back and had a look at the game afterwards, because when you're calling it and you're in the arena, it's a different experience to how you see it.
Yeah, of course.
From what I saw, particularly in quarter number four, the problems that we're seeing with the Hawks came back again, getting lost in the lights a little bit. But with United down the stretch, as great as they were and as immense as they were rising back in, it's not just the Golding shot. There were other shots. They got into some good spots and they just didn't drop.
Mm.
Other nights they drop. Like that Chris Golding shot. First of all, and this comes back into the conversation that we had last week about United and the Tigers lineage. And I've gotten some feedback of that, and we'll get to that a bit later. But
oh, good.
If you're to keep that going as far as United and the Tigers, well, you can say that that's their receipt for 1993 and Andrew Vlahov.
Yeah, that's right.
It's been a long time overdue.
Rim out. Yeah.
It wasn't just him.
I think the Golding three rim outs, the second that the Vlahov rim out has to be the most famous rim out in NBL history, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Like even now, I mean, how long are we talking? 32 years ago, right?
Yeah.
So, oh my God, when you say it out loud, holy cow! But yeah, but Chris's, I had that vision as well. I thought, oh my God, it's Vlahov 2.0.
And I think Perth fans just had a little cheeky smile going to bed Wednesday night after seeing that.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's taken a while, but it got there. Receipts, they always find a way back around. But it wasn't just that shot. It was Ian Clark missing a three down the stretch. They got some good spots and they
it
just...
It was an open three too. They had some open looks and they missed some bunnies
exactly.
as well. That was the other thing. Yeah.
So when
and
I thought...
Ironically, that happened in game three as well, which didn't end up costing them. But man, did they have some bunnies. I mean, yeah. I remember Clark missed one and Lee missed about two or three around the basket that he should have just made. So
when I look back at it and I thought, okay, well, Illawarra did well for three quarters. But that being said, you know, 8 times out of 10, Melbourne still win that game.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So
yeah, there was a certain level of luck involved, shall we say. Not that they didn't deserve to win Illawarra. I don't want to, you know, go that far and say they were lucky to win. I mean, it was a great shot that got on the W, despite all the Melbourne fans screaming at me that it was a travel, which, yeah, you could argue he shuffled his right foot when he launched it. But, yeah, the refs, there were a couple of other travels. I mean, all I'll say is, to any Melbourne fans that complain about refereeing, goaltending. Like, that's just the one word I got to say. So shut up, goaltending, shut up.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So, yeah, so I'm not fussed about the whole travel business. But, yeah, this is the thing. Like, there was a level, and sometimes in championship games that happens. You know, you find a way to make some luck or some luck falls your way. The question is, what do you do with it? And, you know, Mr. Harvey stood up in that ball game and extended the series because, as I said, I'm more convinced than ever now that this thing was done. And it would have been done had they lost that game.
I think as well, if Shaley plays out the game, Melbourne
win. Well, that's the other thing. Yeah.
Melbourne win.
Yeah. Oh, I don't disagree with that. They would have figured it out. Because
he had Harvey under lock.
Yeah. Well, he he has in the one and a bit, what was it, 12 minutes that he played. The one game in 12 minutes, he has had him under lock and key. There's no two ways about that.
And that makes Wednesday night even more vital, particularly if there is no Trey Kell for the Illawarra Hawks. But just one last thing on game two, and then I'll come back to that game three. The air in the building, you talked about when Illawarra lost yesterday in game three and everybody's slinking out. Mm. Boy, did JCA empty quick.
Oh, really?
It was it was a bomb threat, basically. It was an evacuation, underlay, everybody out. I blinked and the building was empty.
Yeah.
It was
funny though. But you can understand it because I'm not going to compare them to Carlton fans. the great migration as it's been called.
Yeah.
But you can understand it in one respect because in that fourth quarter, man, and you talked about it and again it came through so beautifully on the call. Is how jacked they were. And they just got louder and louder. And the closer Melbourne got, the more jacked they became to the point where Rattler, Wayne Peterson, of course, the court announcer, our good friend.
He's been in a suit this playoff series.
Very sharp. I even told him. I said, very sharp, Rattler. But he had them going, which he's want to do. You know, he's not everyone's cup of tea, Rattler. And I understand that. But he's been doing this for a very long time, and he knows what he's doing, and he knows what buttons to push, and he pushed those buttons perfectly. And that crowd was, mate, they were baying for blood down the stretch. They were insane. They were, you know, up and about, and you could hear it through the call. And so it gets to that, and then Harvey fouls Clark makes the free throws. Then Harvey goes down the other end and buries it, and it was like someone pricking a giant balloon. And that's there's the emotion. So you can understand, you just go so flat. I mean, I'm doing it again. I remember it's a very famous shot at what was then called the Sydney Superdome. What was it? 2001. Yes, 2001, when the Kings are playing Townsville and Shane Hill hits a three to either tie or take the lead with about 5 seconds left. And the whole place is going mad, about 8,000, 9,000, whatever it was. And then Rob Rose hits one of the most ridiculous shots you've ever seen in the corner at the buzzer to win it. And it was the same thing. It was like, oh, you know, everyone's up. Oh, we're going to win. And that's what I felt like it was with for that crowd in game two. Yeah. It was a bloody Harvey, and oh no, we how did we lose that? You know, so yeah, I don't blame them for that one iota.
And if you think they were crazy last week, just wait till we get there Wednesday night. They are going to be swinging from the rooftops.
Yeah, it'll be nuts. It'll be nuts, and it'll be the biggest test of Illawarra's season by far, and a tremendous. It'll be a test of their mettle. It'll be a test of their character. And their self-belief. You know, I think one of the keys to their season has been this extraordinary self-belief they have in, you know, in themselves. And they have had, at least internally, an expectation that they were going to do very well, whether that be get to a grand final, get to a championship. So, yeah, it's going to be a significant challenge for them.
Just looking at John Cain Arena, its capacity is 10,300, and apparently it's been hit on one occasion. It was November the 6th, 2022, for a throwdown.
Yep.
I think they are going to break that number on Wednesday. In fact, well, I almost guarantee it.
Yeah. Well, if they're putting in seats, as you said, that's a pointer to it, right?
Yep. It's going to be a madhouse. So, if Illawarra can, look, if we'll get there, but geez, if Illawarra get it done, their miracle is probably the word to describe. I think it's the only word to describe it. Because on the back of that, the building is as loud as I've ever heard it. It's as loud as it's been probably this decade. They get there. It all goes their way. Melbourne don't hit those shots down the stretch. Tyler Harvey hits the coldest game winner that you could imagine. They dance off the court. They silence Melbourne. They head back home. They get a second chance to hold serve. And it doesn't happen again.
Mm.
I said it. I thought that when, especially after Shea Illy was ruled out, I thought, oh, well, there you go. That's a shame, because I think that's probably your series. Because Illawarra having the momentum and the confidence to, okay, we've won a championship game. We did it in Melbourne with that madhouse. And now their best defender, or one of their best defenders, is out. Jeez, you know, we're a real shot at winning this with our home fans. That was, I'm trying to think. We've seen some amazing wins for Melbourne United over the last 10 years. That is right up there. Yeah. That is right up there. To go into Wollongong and to do it a second time without Shea Illy. And hearing the call yesterday with you and Troy, I could barely hear you two, it felt like, at times, because it was that loud in that place. And I know what it can be like. At the Wynn Entertainment Centre.
Yeah.
The
noise in there. We can hardly hear ourselves sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. It bounces off the walls. And the crowd yesterday was enormous. Absolutely enormous. 5,512. I didn't know it could legally hold that many people. And it fell flat again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my heart actually broke for the Hawks yesterday. It really did.
Yeah. Well, those fans in particular. And again, it's really funny. I mean, look, they're cheering. They want their team to win, but you can hear in that fourth quarter, I call it the murmurs. You can just hear people. There's people sitting right. I mean, Oscar Fulmer was sitting right in front of us, ironically, yesterday. But where we are, we're right in the middle of it. You know, we've got – it is a spectacular commentary position that we've got. And, again, I know I've said it before, but I really think – Big Joe and Emma Porter and Jared Novelli and for all their amazing support, and they do it every game for us, and to set us up there, you know, it's like, in some ways I actually prefer it even to sitting courtside, which of course I've called many an NBL game from courtside over the years, but this to me, I just like where it is, because it's only, you know, it's, what is it, probably 8 or 9 rows up. And you just have a great overarching look at the play without, and you're right in the middle of the spectators. Yeah. You're sort of in the middle of the two levels at the WEC.
You're close enough, but you're elevated that you can see everything, and you're amongst
obviously
everyone.
You've caught many a game from that as well. So, yeah, you can see everything, and you know, you nothing blocks your view except when everybody stands up, and we have to stand up, even Truckee, although he's 6'5". But
think he'll be okay.
He's all right. I mean, I'm only 6 foot, but anyway, But yeah, again, the fourth quarter, the same as game one. It was amazing how much it was just virtually an identical situation where, you know, the Hawks got themselves into trouble. They, again, the offense just completely went to crap. It got completely clunky. They played. One of the things I said on the call was that they were taking so much time to get into their stuff. And I mean, obviously, look, Kell goes down and you're left with, you know, Harvey and Dave Ohiki, who, again, you know, hit a couple of threes early but couldn't hit the broadside of a barn when it absolutely was needed to be shots going down from him. And Melbourne just, they cheat off him, they zone off him, they just prove it to us, mate. Until you prove it to us, you can have at it, because they're not even contesting his shots anymore. They don't care. They just, it's like playing 4-on-5. Now he's been great, Davo. And you know, as Troy Pillen pointed out in the broadcast, they were shots you have to take. I mean, they're good shots. It's not like he's forcing anything up. He's not forcing anything under a huge contest or a huge closeout. He's not doing that. He's just being allowed to do the one thing that he hasn't been good at all year, and that is shoot the perimeter shot and knock them down, particularly under the sort of pressure that the team was under at the time. And he's not going to be able to do it. So that's, you know, that's a huge thing, I think, in this series. And it's a big key. It really is. When he's attacking the rim, when he's in transition, he's deadly, Davo. And, you know, you forget sometimes that, you know, I mean, he was so great this year. He was a candidate for Sixth Man of the Year. But the reality is with him, you know, he's been fighting to get a regular place in the league for a very long time. And it's only been since JT came to town that he's kind of solidified his place as an NBL player, which is, of course, a great credit to Coach Tatum that happened. So, yeah. And then that's, yeah, I mean, that was a big part of it in the end.
There was one point watching it from here in Melbourne that I thought, okay, it'll worry 2-1. Once we get to three-quarter time, they go on that, was it 14 unanswered 14, points?
Yeah, 14 unanswered points to end that third, and the place was going absolutely nuts. I think it was Hyung Jung Lee and Darius Dace hit back-to-back threes, and I thought the roof was going to cave in from the noise. It was insane. It was, again, it was like JCA when United were making their run. But this was, you know, the Hawks had been down. It looked like, you know, they were down 7. United were in control. And then all of a sudden, the Hawks race into the end of the third period break with a, what was it? I think a 7-point lead. And then the first points of the fourth period. And so it was then a 14-0 run became a 16-0 run. And what's fascinating about that is that they went away from the things that got them that lead. And for the next, I think it would have been about 30, maybe, or let's say 2 minutes, they missed 4 consecutive 3-point shots.
Yeah.
And it was one, and then there was sandwiched around Chris Golding missed a three, but the Tigers, yeah, I nearly did it. United, they turned the ball over. They, you know, and so they were giving Illawarra chances to absolutely bury them. And instead of doing what they should have done, which is attack the rim and keep putting heat on, they tried to bury them from the three-point line, and it just didn't work. And then I think it was Rob Lowe knocked down a three, finally, and that kind of settled Melbourne down. And yeah, Illawarra just – then they started to fall apart, and you know, Clark came back and hit a floater, and suddenly, oh sorry, Marcus Lee first got inside for a deuce, then Harvey has a turnover, then Ian Clark. So it's a 7-0 run in the space of 60 seconds, basically.
That was and, the moment.
Yeah, and that and when that happened, I actually thought this game's over. They haven't been able to land the knockout blow on them. Their offense in that 2 minute period was just rubbish. It was that they were, I mean, look, you say it's rubbish. On the other hand, Melbourne's defense was insane at the time. It was just, we are not going to allow you guys to get us in a situation where we're coming, you know, back from 16 points down with five to play, where we know it's very unlikely we're going to win. We're going to hang around. But, you know, and they're going to play great D. But the thing, and they got physical, and as I said, they kind of top blocked their shooters who didn't back cut as an adjustment to get that ball, you know, when they had those opportunities because Melbourne were pressing up so high. So, yeah, I mean, they in many ways, they were the architects of their own demise, the Hawks. As brilliant as Melbourne was and as professional, and again, that word experience, which I think is rapidly becoming the theme of these playoffs, that, you know, Illawarra still had their opportunities and they just couldn't take advantage of them.
Kel, Dace, Lee, Harvey, all missed threes in that stretch.
Yep.
And that was the moment that the tide turned for good, because Melbourne locked in defensively, and I was just jaw agape watching the defense for Melbourne United, because I thought it was done when they got up to 10. And you're right, they were looking for that knockout blow, but the second that United sniffed blood in the water, and I think it was that second three miss, because, okay, Killer misses, whatever. Golding goes up the other end of the floor. He misses a three, but Harvey misses the three. They get an offensive rebound. Lee then chucks it up, and he misses. Then Lowe goes down the other end of the floor. Bang, triple. That's when they smell blood. That's when they locked in, and that's when it was just like the slow and painful and methodical demise of the Illawarra Hawks across the rest of the period. It was an extraordinary display from Melbourne United defensively, but again, I just thought Illawarra, it's something I said last week, that the sense of sometimes you got to lose one to win one.
Yeah, 100%.
It really feels like that's going to be the theme of this thing.
It does. Yeah, it really, especially, again, you know, I mean, and look, the person we haven't mentioned yet was a guy who was spectacular. And I mean, he had that run. I think he had 9 straight points in the fourth, and that's Matthew Dellavedova. And his defense was extraordinary, as it always is. I heard later from a friend of ours, a mutual friend of ours, that who's in the media, he had spent so much of himself in that game. He was literally vomiting into a garbage can after the game. He'd given that much of himself. It's not the first time we've seen that. I mean, he did that with Cleveland, and he had those horrendous cramps.
Yeah.
In a championship series, it would have been against the Warriors, and it's just, that's who he is. You know, I mean, he's an unbelievable competitor, and yeah, one of the best we've ever seen. Yeah, in this cut, best we've ever produced. Just. That's why so many people love the dude, because he's a champion, he's a winner, he's a leader, he's got those Damian Martin traits, as I said, and just a spectacular ball player. And you know, to do it at both ends, and then he had 11 assists with no turnovers. He was amazing, just amazing. And you just, to me, he's the favorite for series MVP right now. I think Ian Clark's got definite. Yeah, you know, I mean, he's got a definite chance, and it may depend on game four. But I mean, I think Maddie's been the key to Melbourne this series, even more so than what Illy has been. And let's face it, I mean, Chris Golding hasn't been, you know, as impactful as what most people would have expected so far. Not to say he's not going to go and drop 42 on the Hawks in game four. Well, he could very well do that.
I'm glad you said that, because for so long, how we talk about the Perth Wildcats, and we talked about in this series that, oh, well, Bryce hasn't gone off yet.
Yeah.
We know that Chris Golding has that game in him at John Cain Arena. So look 100%. Out Wednesday night. Look out Wednesday. Mm. But just back to Delhi.
Mm.
And this comes back to what I said, losing one to win one. Sometimes it isn't necessarily the case, but I really do feel like this one, and this is, of course, under the presumption that Melbourne wrap it up on Wednesday, that the best team across the season is going to get beaten by the best team in the playoffs.
Yeah.
And I think a large part of that is, and they're not going to say it yet, but there have been times where I've just watched this series and I thought, you can tell how much last year still lingers.
Yes.
It's burning a hole through them. Yeah, I reckon no more than Matthew Dellavedova.
It is. Oh, there's no question. He wants this badly, man. He does. You know, he's desperate for it. I mean, which, look, he's been to the mountaintop. He's an NBA champion, the same as Ian Clark is. So, same as Jack White is, even though, you know, I mean, didn't play, but he's still part of the squad. But, yeah, I mean, in particular, guys who have been there and actually played in a championship series. Dellavedova has been to the ultimate. But let me tell you, this means probably as much to him as that did, you know, as what he did in Cleveland. So, yeah, it's great to see, you know. I mean, and he's a guy, look, he's at the tail end of his career. He's an Australian Olympian. Not only that, he's a medalist. They can never take that away from him. He's always going to be an Olympic medalist. But this is the one thing that isn't on his resume, and that's a National Basketball League championship. And it's something he clearly wants. Look, he drove himself into the ground in that game yesterday to try and get his team over the line. And he did. He succeeded. It was one of the gutsiest, most courageous performances, particularly with his normal running mate not there. And he had to shoulder even more of a burden defensively. And yet just took it on board, you know, shrugged his shoulders and said, let's just get on with it and let's go to work. And yeah, look, he's one of my favorite players for a reason. You know, I love those guys with that sort of character, that sort of, you know, belief and that, you know, he's kind of a magnetic force in many ways. You know, they coalesce around him. He drives everything that they do. And you know, look, what I'm saying is it's not unique. It's not unusual. These are the sorts of terms that have been used to describe him previously, you know, when he was in the NBA. And why do you think he's been playing for his country for so long? Because everybody needs a player like that. He's special. Yeah, you know, there's no two ways about that. And as I said, I personally, for me, not that I have a vote in the Larry Sengstock medal, but if I did, it would be for Matthew Dellavedova, particularly if they win game four in the series.
Yeah, agreed. It comes back to the experience factor, like we said. Mason Peatling, Todd Blanchfield for the Hawks have been to NBL Championship Series. United had seven guys that were there last year. Eight, if you include Marcus Lee, who was on the other side of things. You can't.
And no disrespect to either Toddy or Mace. You know, they're not guys that were significant contributors in those teams. I mean, Blanchfield hasn't won one yet, but Peatling obviously has. But they weren't significant contributors, right? So this is the thing. And meanwhile, you've got, look, Trey Kell, even game two, he wasn't all that great. You know, he certainly, look, had eight rebounds, made some big shots, made some big plays, had six assists. But he hasn't been like all-NBL first teamer, Trey Kell. Harvey, Harvey was great in a way. Well, not always great in game two. Obviously, he was terrible in game one. And in game three, he just really just didn't get the job done. And these two are all NBL first teamers. And I said it was very simplistic to say, but it was also very true. And it had to be said that if one or both were going to be held in check, particularly both, Illawarra were just going to have a really hard time, because the problem is Melbourne's defense and their experience and Dean Vickerman's coaching, those are the three things that are winning them this series so far. And you know, defense wins championships, as we've said. And the reason they say that is because if you're a club like a Melbourne that can just get stops when you absolutely have to, when it's, you know, balls to the wall time, when it's crunch time, when it's, you know, the crowd's on your case, but you find a way to get a stop. You find a way to take the opposition team out of their rhythm offensively. If you can do all of that, and they have done that in those two home games, that's going to go a long way to getting you a championship at the end of the day.
It's a couple of stats that are very important to highlight out of this series so far. The first one is the time led across the whole series. Illawarra, 81 minutes to Melbourne's 31.
Yeah, remarkable, isn't it?
81 minutes the Hawks have led across the three games to Melbourne's 31. And from our good friend Tommy Hirsch, the big stat, is that in the fourth quarter, the Hawks are being outscored by Melbourne United 84-51.
Yeah.
28 points on average, Melbourne, 17 points on average, Illawarra.
Yeah. That's it. And fourth quarter is, that's winning time. Winning time, baby. That's what it is. And Melbourne are showing it. And, you know, they've just been the team that understands how to win in those scenarios when it gets close. You know, the other thing we haven't talked about was, and you know, Truckee was all over it yesterday, and that was Jack White. You know, and then here's a guy that had maybe one of the worst games of his career in game two. And, you know, had, of course, the well-documented yips at the free throw line, but it wasn't just that. It was just he was a complete non-factor. And that, which is shocking. To say that, but he was. So how do you respond in game three? Well, one of the things you've got in your favor if you're Jack White, and again, I might be, you know, sort of going on a bit too much about it, but it does need to be said. One of the things in your favor is that you've got a great coach in Dean Vickerman who believes in you no matter what. So what happens in the very first play of game three? Melbourne gets the ball. Who do they run a play for? Jack White. What happens? Wide open three. End result. Swish. And then he ends up making his first seven shots. 7 for 7 from the field. He ended up 8 of 9. And, you know, all of that, the yips, all of the supposed lack of confidence, it all went away. And he was an absolute stud. And Illawarra could do nothing with him. He did his job defensively. He was facilitating, you know, just, and when I say facilitating, not necessarily from an assist perspective, but just moving the ball, making the right play. He's a great player. And look, you know, just as a neutral observer, I thought it was fabulous to see, because you love to see those guys that manage to turn things around, especially when they've been in a slump, a little bit of a slump by his lofty standards. And you come into a game three and you're a player down, especially an important player like Shea Ely, and the responsibility is on you. And you've got your coach saying, I'm going to run the first play of the game for you. I'm going to get you an open look. You're going to knock that thing down and we're going to be on our way. And, of course, that's when they jumped the Hawks. It was 8-0 before you blinked, because, of course, CG43 had a couple of baskets and I thought, oh, my God, what the hell is going to happen here? And I mean, to the Hawks' credit, they kind of withstood that and then ended up leading after one. But for Jack White, he just kept going and then just did his business in his usual understated manner. But he's one hell of a ball player. You don't get to be captain of Duke University unless you got something about you, let me tell you. Yeah, Mike Krzyzewski's not going to make you the captain unless he knows what kind of person you are and the sort of character you bring to your ball club. And I thought he was brilliant, and I thought it was a great story coming out of Game 3.
Some points to come out of Game 3, and one of them was the post-game press conference for the Illawarra Hawks.
Yeah.
I'm going to play the audio.
That's, knew that was coming.
Yeah. I'm going to play the audio. This is Justin Tatum yesterday, and we all know, if you're a connoisseur of this program, you know exactly what I'm going to be playing you, but this is Justin Tatum's perspective on the game not stopping after Trey Kell went down in the backcourt, as opposed to when the game was stopped with Matthew Dellavedova went down with a slip. This was Justin Tatum yesterday.
I mean, I don't think it was impact. He slipped, similar like what Deli did, where they stopped the whole game and almost had a holiday to make sure he was okay. But unfortunately, when Trey Kell's and somebody on my team get hurt, you know, we can't look out after them or we can't make sure they're off the court. But at the end of the day, that's just the difference of respect, I guess, you know, between Melbourne and the Hawks. So the NBA did a good job of, you know, making sure they put the right people on there to take care of who they need to take care of.
I think there might be a fine coming his way.
You reckon?
Just a hunch.
Yeah.
What's your take on this?
Look, you know, there's been a lot of talk about those statements, obviously, and yeah, look, he was pissed off and frustrated, and yeah, look. The truth of the matter is, I mean, look, it was a different situation to Delhi's falling down, because that was in the front court and Kel was in the back court and the entire play was, you know, in the front court. But I guess the argument is, well, what happens if there's a turnover and, you know, then you have, you know, the team's going the other way towards Kel, who was clearly injured, and what's going to happen? For me, the funniest thing, and we mentioned it on the call, I couldn't understand why none of the medical staff went straight out for the Illawarra Hawks, went straight out to Kel, the physio or the doc. I don't know why they just kind of stood there. And yeah, I'm thinking, what the hell?
It's very casual, wasn't it?
It was really strange. I still haven't figured it out. And it was the players kind of were sort of mulling around. And then, I mean, Delhi gets the foul call. I think it was Swakala Bullock that hit him. And that was contentious as well, because was he going up for the shot or whatever? And I actually thought, you know, that the foul was intentional, but not unsportsmanlike. I mean, what I mean by intentional was to stop the play to make sure that they could get out to Kel. So, in that respect, I can see JT's point. But it was a slightly different scenario to Delhi going down. And then obviously, you know, there's been that, it's been all season long, this, you know, this long-standing thing between him and Melbourne. You know, this isn't the first rodeo about that stuff sort of happening. You know, we remember that opening game where the infamous Golding flop right in front of him. And, you know, he came into the press conference and said, I'm just so glad that Chris is all right. I'm so glad that he's fine, that, you know, he's not injured and any of that stuff. Oh, I thought that was hilarious. And it just harkened, his words then just harkened back to that. So this is, he's got some history with Melbourne and the NBL. So bottom line, you're right. I think there'll be a bit of a fine coming his way, but I don't think it worries him too much.
Where does that sit on the Jerry Wright scale of talk to Melbourne about Melbourne?
Well, how many times have we had this conversation, Julian? You know, and you know, there's certain people in the United organization that aren't happy about it, but that we do talk about it. But even though he's a minority shareholder now, there's still that perception throughout the league and then about, you know, Mr. Kestelman and Melbourne United and you know, the whole joke about, you know, not the NBL, MBL. I mean, we've been through none of this is new. It just makes me laugh. You know, it just goes on and on and on. And it's, you know, that perception of conflict of interest, whether it's true or not. It's there, and this is when situations like that arise, that stuff will always come out. So yeah, there you go. We probably don't need to go any further with it, but suffice it to say that it's interesting because it's probably not what he said. I still think you'll probably get a fine, but when I think of what, you know, the Jerry Wright situation, I think it wasn't quite as overt as that when you think about it.
No, that was one of the all-time classic press conferences.
God bless him. Yeah,
absolutely. On the other side of it, when it comes from Game 3, I'll ask you first before I go any further. If Trey Kell doesn't get injured, do you think Illawarra win?
No, not necessarily. You know, he wasn't having a great game either, don't forget. It was virtually the same as game one. It was the same scenario just played out yet again. That, you know, you can argue that they were struggling, you know, not quite struggling, but they were at that point where, you know, it just looked like Melbourne were coming and that they weren't going to be able to figure it out. Now, they would have had a better chance of winning had Kel been healthy and on the court. I don't disagree with that. Whether they would have won or not, I can't say that, because Melbourne were getting the job done without Shea Ely anyway. So, you know, regardless of that, they had the advantage and they couldn't take advantage of it. The fact that they were up against an undermanned Melbourne United in their own building, couldn't get it done even with Kel in the lineup. So, yeah, it's a slight what if, but I still think that Melbourne would have found a way.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that him going out of that game was less pivotal than Melbourne losing Shea Illy for the rest of game two, which is bizarre because we're talking about as we move ahead to game four. Even with that, if Melbourne don't have Shea Illy, I still think Trey Kell would be a bigger loss for Illawarra. Not necessarily for what he's doing on the floor, but the fact that Tyler Harvey would be without his running buddy. I think that makes life very difficult for the Hawks in what would already be a difficult situation. What's your take?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, look, it means that there's a lot more pressure on Harvey. It'll be interesting to see who replaces Kell. If Kell, I mean, we're speculating here. We don't know. But I saw the replay of that thing on the big screen at the WEC and my stomach turned because I hate seeing that kind of weird hyperextension of a knee. And automatically you just go to, at best, it's a sprained MCL or PCL, which would definitely have him out, you know, especially with a short turnaround. And even I doubt he'd make game five. Now, of course, he could have miraculous powers of recuperation. What do I know? And I hope for the Hawks' sake, that's the case because it would be, you know, and the same with Shea. I mean, it would be sad if Shea doesn't come up, which I don't think he will. I just can't. Usually, I was talking to Truckee about this, and I think he said something like 11 days. So that, you know, that's kind of the protocol. So if that's the case, then, yeah, Illy's no chance for game four or a potential game five. So, yeah, I mean, look, they'll be praying against everything, against all hope, obviously, that Kell's fine. But what I saw, I'd be very, very surprised. So it puts enormous pressure on Harvey to be the ball carrier. And we've seen with him, when he is the primary ball handler, it's doesn't quite work as well as it has when Kell's been the one really that's been the conductor this year and has been the guy directing traffic. And you play Tyler Harvey off the ball, it's just going to make him super dangerous when he's going to have to carry the ball unless they start Dave O'Hickey, in which and give him the keys. Do I think that's going to work for a whole game? I don't know. I'd be more inclined to start HJ Lee and see if he can break open the game with some threes. But again, it doesn't solve the issue of Harvey being the primary ball carrier, which he's not been as successful. I think Harvey's a classic case. He's a definite 1-2 combo. He can facilitate. And I tell you what, you know, he's had great games this year where he's had really high assist numbers and he's really led the team well. But in this scenario, a game four without his running mate, and, you know, I know it's, look, you're going to say the right things if you're the Hawks and it's next man up mentality and all of that. But the reality is Tyler Harvey is better off the ball than he is on the ball. I think that's been proven. So it's just another massive challenge if that does come to pass. And very interesting to see who JT goes with in the starting lineup. And then after that, how he manages his rotations throughout the game.
Well, when it comes to Trey Kell, we don't know yet. The team have been pretty quiet as far as his status. As far as Shea Illy is concerned, Dean Vickerman spoke on 3AW in Melbourne a little bit earlier tonight, and this is what he had to say about Shea Illy.
Yeah, still undecided. He came off the plane. We got him a workout this afternoon. He looked really good and sharp in that workout. And, we'll take it moment by moment. We'll see how he pulls up from that workout today and see what he looks like tomorrow and we'll go from there.
And a big thank you to the unnamed 3AW producer who sent that audio in. But
gee, I wonder who that could have been.
Wouldn't have a clue.
I don't have a clue.
By the way, you can hear that on 3AW.com.au. Pretty non-committal, which you would expect, but the fact that he, you know, saying that, okay, they put him through a workout and he's come through well, it gives me a little cause for optimism, even if I think the timelines might not necessarily work, but we don't know. I feel a little more optimistic about his chances than I did yesterday.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I think Dino's got to say all the right things and project an aura of positivity about the whole situation. But what I do know is this, that Shea Illy, unfortunately, has had a massive history of concussions.
That's the key.
And, you know, and it nearly cost him his career. So Melbourne are going to take as many precautions as they possibly can with a duty of care to the player as front of mind as possible, regardless of the situation. We all want him as basketball fans out on the court. He's a fabulous basketball player. He plays with an unbelievable passion, intensity, energy. He's full throttle every moment on that he's on the floor, and which occasionally has been, unfortunately, to his detriment with these concussions. So I think fundamentally, I think if there's the absolute slightest, and I mean slightest chance, that this thing could crop up again, even if he passes all his tests, even if he looks fine, even if he says, I'm good to go, they are going to be absolutely 100% committed to the health of the player first, because that is what is most important. So my thinking of it is, I just don't think he's going to play. I hope I'm proven wrong. I hope he's all right, but I just think it's too much of a risk with his history. It's unfortunate, but you just, you know, and Melbourne United have shown tremendous care to Shea, and I don't think that doesn't change despite the fact we're in a championship series, and in particular, a game where they could actually win the championship, especially at home. I just don't think they take the risk.
Yeah, from hearing that, he went from a 0% chance in my mind to a 10% chance. I'd be stunned if he was there.
Yeah, I would be. That's the point. And of course, and Dino said, look, there's nothing wrong with what Dino said. He's absolutely on the money. He's got to project that, right? But I think the reality is that it's about that. For me, it's about the care for the player, the individual, you know, or not even just the player, the person as well. And they've got to look after him. They've done a fantastic job with that, Melbourne. They really have. And I don't see that changing now.
So if Shaley isn't there, you expect more of the same Wednesday night in the way that they cover his absence?
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, you know, again, Troy Pillen, who did such a fabulous job alongside me in commentary yesterday, he brought up the point that Melbourne is perhaps the one team. Now, Illawarra has maybe the best depth in the league, but Melbourne is the one team that can cover for a Shea Illy better than anybody else, the absence of a Shea Illy type, because you've got Matthew Dellavedova. Because you've got Ian Clark, because you've got Christopher Golding, you've got those guys, you know. Whereas with Trey Kell going down, you're not going to have, you don't have an Olympian alongside him, and you don't have an NBA champion to come up and fill the void. Do you know what I mean? And that's the difference. So with Shea, he can be a lot better covered at that position than what perhaps Illawarra could with Kell, you know, assuming Kell doesn't play. So yeah. It'll be just more of the same. I don't know if you want to start, but with game four, I have a sneaking suspicion it's going to get ugly. It's just one of those things. Now, you never say never about Illawarra. And all the games have been close. You know, they have been. And as you mentioned, you know, Illawarra have led for the majority of the series. So by that metric, they should still have a really strong chance of forcing a game five, but I have a sneaking suspicion Melbourne's about to turn it on, you know, and have one of those games where, as I mentioned before, CG43 is going to find his groove, and it could get to that point really early, really quickly, where it just builds and builds and builds, and suddenly you look up and Melbourne's leading by 25, and the championship's done. And it could be, you know, as early as midway through the third quarter, something along those lines, even before halftime. So that's even without Illy. Yeah, and Illy, again, like Matty, is such a driving force for that team. But, yeah, and I hope he does play, but my sneaking suspicion is he won't. But even then, I don't think it'll matter. I think Melbourne were mad that they let that game two slip in the end. They were outplayed for three quarters. There's no doubt about that in game two. But they still gave themselves an opportunity to win the game regardless. So they feel like they can beat Illawarra under any circumstances, I think. And as I said, it was a rim out CG43 triple, away from a potential sweep. So I my gut feel is that Melbourne's going to get the job done and probably get the job done pretty comfortably in game four. I don't see a way for for Illawarra to turn this into a game five. I just think the experience is too much. And the motivation, which hasn't been talked about enough. I think you in particular, Julian, have been very, very big on this whole notion that, you know, that loss last year has fueled the fire. You know, and they've lost some guys from that team. And there was a school of thought that they weren't as strong a group as they were last year. And that's probably right. But they, again, they still have a lot of guys that have long memories. And I think it's fueled them all year at the end of the day, even with their ups and downs.
Yeah, still got seven guys who are on that squad from last year. And I keep saying the eighth was Marcus Lee, who was on the Tasmania team.
Yeah.
But they had seven guys who experienced that last year. And even when they went through that slump throughout December and January, look, on the surface, are they as talented as they were last year?
No.
Of course they aren't.
No.
But I've said it throughout the last couple of programs. The best team throughout the season, Illawarra, I think are going to get beaten by the best team in the playoffs. And it does happen from time to time in sport. And we've seen it, you know.
Teams get hot at the right time of year, you know, when it comes down to the clutch. And, yeah, it looks like this is what we're witnessing.
Yeah, I mean, that sport in Australia especially, it's littered throughout history with teams like this.
Western Bulldogs, for one. You know, there's a classic case. It's not the same, but, I mean, that was a team that came from nowhere to win the AFL Premiership.
Yeah, and beat the best team throughout that season, who were the Sydney Swans, quite convincingly. NRL-wise, Parramatta Eels of 2001, historic, but were beaten up by a better team on grand final night. Even go further back, 1991, West Coast Eagles were by far the best team in the competition. They were beaten by the Hawks. You know why? Because Hawthorn were in 100 grand finals in the last 101 years going into that. Experience in championship.
That's a good point. That experience word again. Yeah, absolutely.
It's paramount. And that's one thing. But then you've got to remember the way that Melbourne United lost that championship series last year. It was a Jack McVay miracle bomb in game three. They go down to Tasmania in game four. They steal it away from them. And then they get pipped at the post in game five by 2 points. And mind you, Matthew Dellavedova goes, hooks it up from midcourt and almost pulls
off. Made it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's how close they were. You don't think that's going to sting? Of course it stung.
Yeah.
And even speaking with people in the United camp last week, I don't know for a fact, it absolutely still stinks. So they are a very motivated bunch, which is why if Illawarra can keep the band mostly together, I suspect that I'll be saying the same thing in 12 months about them. Of course, that is a great unknown. But if they do manage to be in a similar position where they have, you know, most of the cast from this year, including the coach, I would be saying exactly the same thing about them, because the experience is one thing, but the motivation, that's the added X factor that Melbourne have in this series. Which, by the way, I should tell you, as of 8:48 p.m. local time, there are no more tickets left at John Cain Arena. So it is not only a sellout, it is a sellout deluxe, because they fit in extra seats where there aren't usually seats. So you're going to have a building that is ready to celebrate. They're going to be swinging off the rafters after you've just dropped two games on your home floor and you may be without Trey Kell. If they win the Hawks, it will be a fairy tale. It will be a miracle. It would be Tasmania-esque almost at this point, Matt, if they somehow walk out of Melbourne on Wednesday with a win.
No question. And, of course, purely selfishly, I want there to be a game five, because I think, you know, it's always a privilege to call it. You know, I've had that privilege a couple of times and there's nothing like it. You know, one game for all the marbles. I mean, it's in Australia, you know, historically we don't really understand the concept of a series other than perhaps, you know, State of Origin Rugby League. But apart from that, you know, everything else is a grand final. So if it comes down to the fifth game, one game for the whole thing, you know, that's when you get, you know, the biggest crowd in NBL history, as was the case when the Kings beat New Zealand in that five-game series. that, you know, because it is an Australian's definition of a, quote, grand final. It's that one game, whoever wins is the champion. So from that perspective, I do, you know, hope and pray that it goes five. I just think that I just don't see it happening. I just can't see them going to the well again one more time. Look, I've been proven wrong many times in the past. I hope that's the case again. As Troy Pillen says, I have a way of calling a game before it's even, you know, even close to being over. So calling the result, that is. So I sincerely hope that I'm wrong in this instance. But, yeah, it would be a fairy tale for sure. And, you know, and again, it would set up what would be an extraordinary afternoon, because it's an earlier time slot. If game five comes around, it's a 2:30 time slot, which would be absolutely ideal. The place would be full probably, you know, half an hour to 45 minutes before the game even started.
Could they get a court on Wynn Stadium in time if that was the case?
Yeah.
You'd fill it.
Yeah. I don't know. But, yeah, it would be awesome. It'd be absolutely – game five would be fantastic. There's no doubt. I seriously doubt it'll get to that point.
I will. Look, I've been wrong at every turn with this series, so I
am. Yeah, I know. So who the hell knows? Yeah. We could. I mean, we have been, and you know, I even in game two, I mean, I picked Illawarra to win, but that was, you know, I said was heart more than head, no doubt. You know, I was fully expecting Melbourne to win, but I was hopeful that Illawarra could find a way to get it back to, you know, a best of three series essentially, which is what that became. But then, you know, Melbourne again crashed the party in game three. You know, I was more – if Illawarra had won that game, I was still convinced it was going five, because I just couldn't see Melbourne being beaten three straight times in the series. And, you know, so for them to lose, this is where I'm at now, thinking, well, you know, Melbourne's got all the momentum coming off that really gutsy, tough performance in game three.
We've got time for a couple of quick news items before we finish up. One thing which is massive, certainly in this city, the New Orleans Pelicans are coming to town in October.
Yeah, fabulous, isn't it?
Rod Laver Arena.
Yeah, and yeah, we've been talking about it. Yeah, we actually wanted an NBL game in there. We've got an NBA game in there, which is, well, you know, NBL x NBA, NBA x NBL rather. But, yeah, fabulous. And what I love is hearing from the Pelicans and them saying that they're taking this very seriously. They're actually using it as an extended training camp. They're going to be doing a lot of outreach in Melbourne through the NBA Cares program, which is super successful. So Melbourne basketball kids are in for a real treat, you know, and I'm very happy for them. It's going to be an exciting time to be a basketball fan, obviously an NBA fan. They're bringing everybody. Look, they're not, it's not like it's the Lakers with LeBron and Luka, or the Celtics with Jason and Jalen, or, you know, I mean, that obviously there's, you know, there's, or even OKC with Gilgeous Alexander or Donovan Mitchell, the Cavs, whatever. But still, you know, it's going to be, you know, Zion Williamson and for all the jokes about his weight and all their guys. So, I mean, it's fabulous. And it'll be a roaring success, of course, because, you know, we've said Melbourne is the, you know, basketball capital of the country, and there's going to be 15,500 people there, or 15,000, whatever it holds these days, Rod Laver, to watch Melbourne United and the Phoenix do battle with an NBA team that will have everybody there, and will treat these preseason games like the real thing.
Yeah, the week after the AFL Grand Final in Melbourne. So it's Friday night, October 3rd, Melbourne United, who may well be taking the court as reigning NBL champions. And then Sunday, October the 5th, it will be the Southeast Melbourne Phoenix's turn to take on the Pelicans. We'll be talking about that more in the coming months, I'm sure. This one could have knocked me over with a feather, Matty. Andrew Bogut.
Bogut.
Assistant coach, Sydney Kings, 2025-26.
Yeah.
Who the hell would have picked this?
Well, it shocked me because, he's been talking about wanting to take a more hands-on approach with the club. He's been, you know, he's been vocal about that.
Well, he was not good.
Yeah, but I didn't pick it for a coaching position, particularly an assistant coaching position. You know, on the surface, it looks rather interesting, to say the least, given the fact that he's also, you know, a minority owner of the club, who's now an assistant coach to a man who ostensibly is reporting to him. Of course, that's not really the case. I mean, Gorge is reporting to Matt Denneman and the Willamy Capital Group, because they're the majority, they're the owners. So that's who he's dealing with. They're the majority owners of the club. But look, yeah, and I was talking to, you know, we talked to Matt Logue about this in Shootaround, and he mentioned that, you know, Brian Gorgian had already, this is not something that is actually out of the blue in some instances, some aspects rather, that because Gorge, as Matt said, actually invited him to be a part of the coaching staff prior to the Tokyo Olympics. So that's how far back it goes. And at that period of time, he was, you know, he basically felt like he wasn't ready for it, so he declined. But yeah, he's clearly gotten more of an itch to become involved. I was, in all honesty, I was expecting it more from a front office perspective, as in, I thought to myself, well, is this an indication that perhaps they're going to move on from Chris Bongrass as kind of the GM of basketball, and that's the role he'll step into? But he's talking even more hands-on right there in the thick of it. So he'll join Brian and Billy and Sean Roger in the coaching booth. So that's going to be really interesting going forward. I mean, one thing we know about Andrew that, you know, I think it'll be a good hire in one respect. He's a super intelligent guy. He doesn't suffer fools. He's very straightforward. He lets you know what he's thinking. And, you know, he's going to be tough on them. And maybe after what happened this season, maybe that's what needs to happen. Maybe there needs to be that level of toughness from the coaching perspective. And Bogut might be the guy because, look, you're hardly going to... You're not going to disrespect him. I mean, this is a guy, you know, again, NBA champion, right? Has been just an amazing basketball player, had a tremendous career, whether it be in college, whether it be at the NBA level, and, you know, and at the NBL level, you know, obviously league MVP. So, yeah, look, people may scoff and laugh because I know that, look, I know Andrew quite well, and I'm very friendly with Andrew and have been for a very long time. So I've got a great relationship with him. But you know, the one thing I don't do is you know, look on some of the stuff he says on Twitter or X, whatever it is. You know, my rule is that I with X, I tend to just focus in on the basketball stuff anyway on social media, the good basketball stuff, and not, you know, because we all know it can be a bloody cesspool at times. So, you know, I tend to ignore what he says on social media from not a basketball perspective, if you know what I mean. But in terms of basketball, you know, knowledge and understanding, he's got a great mind. He's one of the smartest basketball players we've ever produced as well. You know, and obviously, you know, he was a genius level passer. I've always talked about this, that I kind of look at, you know, you look at Bill Walton, you look at Arvydas Sabonis. These days, you look at Nikola Jokic. But Andrew Bogut, it's because we talked about Vlahov earlier. Andrew Bogut was right up there as a passer of the basketball from the big man position. You know, he was genius level. He really was. You know, Steve Kerr even talks about it, you know, when they had their one of their championship anniversaries recently, and he was asked about Bogut, and he thought Bogut was the most underrated player he had because he was, first of all, he was incredible anchoring that defense, but also, you know, just his passing. Just, he was an amazing passer of the ball as a big man. So, yeah, so you've got all that. And as a player, you know, he's got gravitas. He's got, you're hardly going to argue with him. You know, I'd be very surprised because he's going to let you know what he thinks. Yeah. He's going to, and he won't sugarcoat anything. And like I said, maybe that's what's required at the Sydney Kings. You know, they've been talking about, look, the culture hasn't been good for 2 years now. And it needs to change. And clearly it does because they haven't been successful in those 2 years. So, you know, who knows? This could be, this could work out really, really well for the Sydney Kings.
Stuff to get ourselves into for our postseason shows, I am sure. That wraps it up for this week. We'll be back next week with a post-grand final wrap. And I'll ask you one more time, Maddie, if Melbourne win it on Wednesday night, will I be saying it's their third or their seventh title?
Third. And we apologise we didn't get to a couple of questions that came through on X. We will talk about those next week.
Absolutely, we will. We'll be
back. A bit short on time this week, so we apologise. It's a shorter one than you used to, but hopefully we packed enough in to keep you interested.
Absolutely. The Collective will be on the call Wednesday night from 7 p.m. I'll be alongside Tom Hirsch and Jamie Hamilton. And if the Hawks do it, Game 5 in Wollongong Sunday afternoon. We'll be back next week with our post-championship wrap. You're on the Roundtable.